Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the voice of the frontline protector here at the Private Officer Beat Radio. Every week, you'll hear breaking news, topics of training, information for the industry of security, public safety, and law enforcement. So strap in, hang on, we're about to speed off in this episode of the Private Officer Beat Radio. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Private Officer Beat Radio, a production of Private Officer International, a security and law enforcement association. I'm your host, Rick McCann, founder and CEO of Private Officer International, Armor College, and several other businesses. We're so happy to be with you on this Memorial Day. Yep, we are broadcasting live from our studio on this Memorial Day 2021. I understand that many of you are Hopefully many of you are out enjoying the lakes and the rivers and the ocean, fishing, barbecuing, spending time with family and friends. And though many of you may not be able to enjoy this program live, hey, lucky for you, we have all of our programs, more than 555, now available on demand 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even holidays like today, and now streaming live on the iHeartRadio Network and Amazon Radio. We're so proud to be partners with both the iHeartRadio and the Amazon Network, and we have a lot more exciting things to announce in the upcoming weeks. We are beginning to partner with several large groups as we align our pillars of what we built this organization on with other organizations and businesses. So we'll be able to bring you really specialized training, products, services as a member and non-member alike. Well, even though it's Memorial Day weekend, when we think of all of the sacrifices that have occurred throughout the years for our freedom and the many who have given up their life in service to others that we might be free, we know that there is a lot of conflicts across the country and around the world. And right here in our own country, not only are the police fighting those conflicts and having to defend themselves both in the field as well as in the court, in the security industry, we too are facing an onslaught of deadly violence. In 8 days, our security personnel had to defend themselves 17 times using deadly force, 5 times, killing 5 people. And that is going to continue to increase, unfortunately. And as more and more security officers are becoming involved, interacting with the public in an enforcement capacity, as they uphold the rules and the statutes and laws, they are being attacked left and right and are having to defend themselves. As you know, through our conversations over the years, we've discussed the evolution of private security and how it's gone from access to control to much more of an enforcement level, armed enforcement level many times, and really taking over much of what law enforcement used to do. And in fact, we have a brand new program at Armor College, which we are kicking off the first session coming up on June the 8th called Private Policing Business, because in many states, you can begin your own private police agency, or in many other states, you can work as a private police officer for universities, hospitals, and other entities. We have a lot of news as well that we want to bring up to you here in a few minutes. I hope that you enjoyed our From the Loss Prevention Zone yesterday on the Private Officer Beat Radio Network, LP Zone, where everything is about loss prevention, asset control, fraud, and retail crimes. If you missed it, and I don't blame you, it was the holiday weekend. It is a holiday weekend. You can go back, like I said, and listen to it on demand anytime, both on our platforms as well as iHeartRadio. Contact us at helpdesk@privateofficer.com, helpdesk@privateofficer.com, if you're not sure where to get those radio shows, and we'll be glad to send you those links. Also, we'll be talking today, again, really in the third issue, about mental health emergency responses, as more and more security companies and proprietary companies are having to interact with those having some type of mental health emergency. We talked about, and it's real, it's very real. We talked about last week, both in our From the Legal Side as well as our weekly radio show, about emergency responses to mental health issues. We talked about excited delirium on Monday, a real thing. You need to get familiar with these, not only these terms and definitions, but how to recognize them and what type of response you should have, what type of intervention that you should have, and how to protect yourself. Also today, we are going to continue talking about mental health emergencies, but we're also going to announce a couple of programs that we have to help you get more familiar with what you're probably already seeing and just don't recognize it. Many of our security personnel work day after day with people. They're at the mall. They're at the hospital. They're in apartment complexes. They're on patrol. They're working college campuses, high schools, interacting with so many people. When we come back from this first break, we want to talk about some very important breaking news as well as mental health emergencies. You're listening to the Private Officer Beat Radio. I'm your host, Rick McCann. Remember, check out our friends at Body Armor USA, because we've got what it takes to protect you, and there's not even a little doubt about that. BodyArmorUSA.com. We've got the best protective clothing, stab-resistant vest and gloves, body armor. Our friends there at BodyArmorUSA.com, they're going to take care of you. We'll be right back.
You don't know what it's like until you're a parent. Letting go.
Because we used to protect her.
But now with the Smart Pepper Spray from Saber, we can feel a little better knowing that if something happens, she can protect herself. Not only is it the number one pepper spray brand, it also has smart features to connect us instantly when it matters most. The Smart Pepper Spray connects via Bluetooth to the free Saber Personal Safety app. With her selected contacts loaded into the app, we receive an alert if and when the pepper spray is deployed. Even better, the alert links to a map where we can geotrack her exact location to make sure she gets to safety. We also opted into the Saber Premium Monitoring Service to make sure that if needed, local police will be alerted and given the ability to track and help her. That's all built on top of Saber's maximum strength formula for maximum stopping power. with a 10-foot range and 25 bursts per canister.
So if she's ever in a dangerous situation,
we'll know.
Is everything okay?
I'm fine. I just got scared, but I'm fine.
Oh, thank goodness.
Because when you're a dad,
when you're a mom,
knowing that your daughter, your loved ones are safe,
that's
everything.
In a minute, I'm going to drown in this pool, surrounded by friends and relatives. That's because Dad thinks Mom is watching me, and Mom thinks Dad is. But actually, nobody is watching me. And you rarely make a sound when you're struggling the most.
Don't assume someone else is watching. Become a water watchdog at abbyshope.org.
Today's program, we want to recognize a very close and dear friend of ours, Mike Thornhill, in Nashville, Tennessee. He recently retired 18 years as a security chief for a college campus in the nearby town outside of Nashville. But he didn't stay retired for very long. In fact, he went right to work for a local department as a protection specialist, so we want to congratulate him on his retirement as well as his new job. A friend of mine, Brian Corley, also retired in law enforcement in the past couple of months, and he started his security company. And, you know, they tell me that if you want to stay young and not get old, you just keep busy. And so I have been, but I'm starting to wear out. So I thought the word retirement has something to do with not working anymore. I'm going to have to check the Webster Dictionary because it seems like everyone I know who's retiring is going right back to work. A friend of mine last year retired after 47 years, and he went right back to work full-time at another job. So I guess that is a way to stay young, stay active. So congratulations to those guys. I also want to congratulate a security officer in Manassas, Virginia. That's Northern Virginia, Leroy Williams. He did several things that were quite remarkable. First of all, he spent 42 years of his life as a school security officer at one school, in one town, in one state. Leroy Williams was a security officer at the Metz Middle School in Manassas, Virginia for 42 years. And on Friday, he did something that kind of came as a surprise, and that was he retired. It's hard to find good employees. It's hard to find dedicated employees. It's hard to find committed people. But Mr. Williams, he said it was all about showing up. If he showed up, he might be able to make a difference. And he certainly did. And on Friday, people showed up for him. They gave him a surprise celebration. Everyone from law enforcement and fire service to politicians to school graduates that came back years later. Mr. Williams said he could not believe all of the commotion, all of the people. In fact, there was a parade of cars and school buses filled with those people congratulating him. He said that in order to make an impact on a person's life, you just got to show up. If you sit at home, if you don't come in and do the job, if you don't show up, you're not going to have the opportunity to affect a real change. And so he did show up for 42 years. Many people congratulating him on his retirement. They just shook his hand. They cried. Mr. Williams cried. One young man who was there to congratulate him became his godson, all because Mr. Williams showed up. The student needed some help, needed a friend. He needed someone that he could depend on. He was in trouble. He had received an in-school suspension. So he talked with the security officer, who would soon become his godfather. Show up, he said. And so Private Officer International is going to show up in a big way for Mr. Williams. Not only are we presenting him with a plaque for his lifetime achievement and a lifetime membership to Private Officer International, but we've got some more goodies in the works, and we're going to be bringing that to you live when it happens. What a man. What a person. It is just unbelievable, the commitment that one person could have, not only for an employer or a business, but for literally hundreds and hundreds of students and faculty through the years. Coming out of Phoenix, Arizona, police there have arrested four men and charged them with a jewelry heist from the Sam's Club. Jamone Williams, Derek Welch, and Darius Sutton, and the juvenile, all charged now with stealing $100,000 in gold and engagement rings. They broke in to the store and was able to leave with a packed jewelry. Police finally was able to use a GPS tracking device that was in the security shipment and made the arrest. In Schenectady, New York, Upper State New York, a former nursing student who suffered psychological trauma after being stabbed in the neck by a patient is not only suing the hospital, but the security company that had the contract to provide security. She said that while there, she'd seen many incidents of violence, a lack of security, and no controls put into place by Ellis Hospital. The lawsuit will soon go through the court system, and we will definitely be watching. A 63-year-old woman arrested just the other day in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Nashville International Airport after she breached security because she said that she was late for her flight. When confronted by TSA and law enforcement, she began to struggle, resisted officers, and had to be taken to the ground and handcuffed. She's been arrested on several misdemeanors. Also making the news this past week, a security officer was stabbed. This happened at a hotel chain in Washington, D.C. There's no information about his injuries or if anyone was prosecuted in this case. In Memphis, Cordova, Tennessee, which is a part of Memphis, Kavirius McNeil, 27, has been arrested for shooting a security officer at the Blow Hookah Lounge. This after a verbal altercation. Police have him in custody with no bond. Coming out of Compton, California, a lawsuit that was just filed, which we are following, accuses the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department with ghost car patrol, a scam sometimes used by, unfortunately, private security companies where they bill a client for patrols and services never made or for people that were never on the job. Well, that's what's happening here in Compton, California. According to Compton representatives, they said it had gone on for years. They pay the sheriff's department more than $22 million a year to police the city. And in exchange, the deputies are supposed to spend a certain amount of time each month patrolling the streets of Compton, but they have evidence that the sheriff's deputies not only did not patrol regularly, but sometimes weren't there at all. So they are accusing the LA Sheriff's Department for ghost billing, not a few dollars, but hundreds of millions of dollars. And we're going to follow this case. We see it sometimes involving law enforcement, but more often involving private security. A case that has gone on for a number of years. And when I say a number, I mean 10 years. Coming out of New Orleans, Louisiana, where an armored car security officer was killed during a armored car robbery at a bank in 2013. Now, after many trials, many wranglings of the law, the three agreed to plead guilty and have been sentenced to more than 40 years in prison. We've done several stories on this particular shooting and the security officers involved, as well as the suspects. And on our brand new show, the Frontline TV program, we're going to be reviewing the outcome later this year as well. They should probably write a book about this. A man who shot himself in the leg accidentally at the Manassas Mall in Virginia is now arrested. 22-year-old Alexandria man was charged with reckless handling of a firearm after he shot himself in the leg in the mall. Police say a witness reported hearing a gunshot and called 911. The man began to flee in his vehicle, but Prince William County Police were able to pull him over. Another occupant of the car immediately fled. No other charges are involved. He was also charged with reckless handling of a firearm, no permit. Coming out of Tulsa, Oklahoma this past week, two people, including a unarmed security officer, was shot. Police say that a security officer was checking out a noise around 10 p.m. when a woman in a vehicle pulled out a gun and fired directly at his chest. The security officer was wearing a bulletproof vest, and he was armed. I said unarmed, but he was armed, and he did return fire, and he also hit the woman. Police are investigating what caused the woman to take this type of action. She is now in police custody. More and more, we're hearing about residents of various communities hiring their own private security to combat the rising crime. In Baltimore, Maryland, the Federal Hill community just recently also hired a private patrol service. All of the community residents contributed about $18,000 to start off the fund with to support having their own security staff. Much news in the media. We go through it every single day. Too much to mention all of it, obviously, but if you want to see all of our breaking news daily, go to our daily news blog at privateofficerbreakingnews.blogspot.com or go to our website at privateofficer.org. A box will drop down. You can fill it out, and you can instantly get breaking news headlines when something major occurs, when there's a security officer injured or killed, or occasional training and news opportunities. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking this week again about mental health emergencies, part three, and we're going to be looking at some other things coming up here at POI. You're listening to the Private Officer Beat Radio. We'll be right back.
I was just going to the grocery store.
Seatbelt violators, beware.
I forgot to put it on.
If you're pulled over because you've broken the law,
oh, it's so uncomfortable.
And you're not wearing your seatbelt.
It's broken, but I was going to have it fixed.
No matter what your excuse is, you will get a ticket in addition to the ticket for your original violation.
Click it or ticket? That's pretty easy to remember.
doing lying in this casket? Oh yeah, that's right. I'm dead. I got shot. I'm not supposed to be dead. I'm only 17. And now I can't see my 18th birthday because I'm a fatal victim of gun violence. My friends, my family, my own mother was devastated. Can't see her son anymore because of gun violence. And everyone's here at the funeral. But before they lay me to rest, there's just one last thing I have to do. How many more of us have to die from gun violence? Let's put a stop to this, because if we don't, the next time it could be your child lying in this casket.
Brought to you by Man Up Inc. USA, a proud member of the Gun Violence Awareness Movement.
I think I mentioned last week that we are excited, very excited. In fact, if I had the ability to really echo my excitement and have a big fanfare behind me, I would, maybe on the next program. But we're very excited about a trip that we're taking to Montana, and we're going out west to do some training. We'll be gone for several weeks. If you're in any of the mid U.S. central states or the upper western region, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Montana, if you're in New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, we're going to be in those states as well. Contact us at helpdesk@privateofficer.com. We have quite a few programs that we can bring to you, but some of the ones that we really are doing aggressively is the mental health, illness, emergency response, as well as de-escalation and use of force, rethinking our options. And we're also always teaching lethal and less lethal weapons, including electronic weapons, chemical weapons, as well as the more lethal weapons. If you want to see our course offering, contact helpdesk@privateofficer.com, and they will send that over to Armor College. We also do a lot of church security, first aid and CPR, stop the bleed, and so much more. Contact us today, and we will put you on the schedule. We'd love to meet you along the way as well. Be sure to contact us, helpdesk@privateofficer.com. This week, we want to remind you that we're going to be offering a very unique program coming up at Armor College, and that is the it's really unique. It's called Command Staff College. You hear about this sometimes with the FBI and certain law enforcement agencies that offer it through the Command College program, and we're offering this as well in cooperation with several other entities, as we've mentioned in the past. We believe that this will be coming up starting within the next few months. We're currently taking applications. Contact us at helpdesk@armour.org for more information. You have to be a supervisor, manager, a chief of either a private or public entity, agency. It doesn't have to be law enforcement. It could be at a school. It could be a contract agency. It could be a hospital. Contact us again at helpdesk@armour.org. We have a lot of things happening, and one of the most unique opportunities, I think, is one that we have promoted a few years back, where we assisted several folks in starting their own business. We're going to put this opportunity out later next month. If you are interested in starting your own contract security agency or your own vocational school, doesn't have to be a security guard school, could be a vocational school, we have several opportunities where we can help you up and running, get you up and running, and help you out immediately with very little funding. We're going to do the funding for you. And so be listening to our radio programs. If you're not already getting our emails, go to our website at privateofficer.org. Sign up today, because this is really a very special and unique opportunity for people who may not have a lot of money, but they have the experience and the skills, and they're willing to be mentored, and they will listen. I think that this is going to be a great opportunity. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking today about mental health emergencies and how you probably already interact with these type of situations and may not even realize it. We'll be right back.
Nurse, I need you to apply pressure to the head wound until I can get to it. I'm concerned she's lost too much blood.
Oh, no.
You in the corner, who are you? You're not supposed to be here.
She's my girlfriend, doctor.
You need to wait out in the waiting room.
Please, doctor, I want to stay with her.
Look, she's been badly injured. So if you want to do what's best for her, you need to let us do our work.
Please, doctor, she has to be okay. I didn't mean to do this. I love her.
Wait a second. You were the driver?
Yes, but I didn't mean to. I swear, we went to dinner. I was just buzzed. I only had a few drinks.
Just buzzed? Why didn't you tell us that? In that case, your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie. I feel great. You want to get out of here?
I can't believe this. Really, doctor? She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No, not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ad Council, and this state.
Without this woman, my father couldn't have had his hip replaced.
Without these people, I'd be dead.
This man helped my son through leukemia.
Do something amazing. Give blood.
Some in the public are very disillusioned about the reality of force in the police world. In a study on university students' perception of police use of force that we just conducted, out of approximately 400 subjects across five different campuses, the average student reported law enforcement use of deadly force at a rate of 1 out of 5 citizen encounters. Wow, is that unrealistic? Now, they get that from many different sources, primarily television. But the reality is, from multiple studies involving over 20 million law enforcement citizen contacts, 20 million, the studies inform us that actual use of force is less than 0.1%. And that is in all citizen encounters, less than 0.1%. In all criminal arrests, the use of force is less than 1%. With very few reported injuries. However, society has seen lawful but awful incidences, particularly under the intense scrutiny and criticism of the press. And they are now asking officers to perform at a higher level, though they don't really know how or what that is. At the same time, officers are more frequently being called to respond to incidences involving people with mental illness, disorganized thinking, or in a personal crisis. And just like all other problems, society is seeking a simple solution.
to a very complicated and difficult problem. And that solution they're seeking is labeled de-escalation. Now, we can't define de-escalation, but they believe they will know it when they see it. And this is important. Not all people who call for the police to use de-escalation really understand it themselves. De-escalation is not some magic formula or words that can turn all rational but uncooperative criminal suspects into cooperative ones. It's also not something that magically allows officers to successfully communicate with a person who is so profoundly in crisis that they're unresponsive to anything outside of themselves. How does force science see de-escalation? Well, for this, we need to attribute it to one of our presenters, Bill Everett, an attorney, who has labeled it a systems-based approach. And this is agency-wide. It's an agency-wide systems approach for using opportunities, knowledge, skills, and abilities to resolve problems with minimal harm, not minimal force, and to do that where possible, which means there has to be an opportunity for it to occur. Doctors cannot promise to save everyone's life, and officers can't promise to resolve every situation without harm, but they will try their best if there is an opportunity to do so. And this systems-based approach includes the use of specific communications, but not just communications. It also involves behavioral tactics to diffuse potentially violent encounters and use time to slow things down to reduce risk to both the officer and the others. The basic task is to provide psychological first aid, just like you do medical first aid. The purpose is not to do therapy or to provide therapy, but to provide an effective transition from the street to treatment. Now, one issue that causes confusion is that those advocating de-escalation often fail to distinguish between a person in a crisis and a criminal suspect. De-escalation is most appropriate when there's a person in crisis. And it's not that you'd never use de-escalation or conflict communications on criminal suspects, but caution must be used in that you do not necessarily want to lose the first and possibly best opportunity to take the person into custody. When you have a non-compliant criminal suspect, de-escalation tactics can actually backfire, slowing things down, and give them the advantage and increase the risk to you. With a person in crisis, slowing things down and employing de-escalation tactics may reduce the risk to you and to them. And that's a goal. Of course, someone can be both a criminal suspect and a person in crisis. Now, simply, society appears to view those law enforcement encounters in the street, those that law enforcement encounter in the street, as falling within one of two categories, those who are criminals and those who are in a mental health crisis. With those who are criminal, you use conflict communication. And with those in a crisis, you use crisis communication. Then everything will de-escalate and resolve itself without force. And you know it's not as simple as that.
All right, thanks, Bill. I'm going to get into transition a little bit into what the law requires, and it's going to take a little prep here to get started. First off, as Shannon mentioned right at the beginning, this is not legal advice, and there's just no way in the few minutes, the limited time that we have here, to do a comprehensive overview of how all the various circuit courts, federal circuit courts, that cases for all the people that are on this call. There's no way to go through them all. So that's the first thing. This is just going to be, we're going to talk about a couple of different cases, and we're primarily using them because they make sense. And the concepts are pretty sound. The other thing you have to understand is that what most of the cases that deal with excessive force cases, for instance, most of these cases are cases involving a review of a district court for granting summary judgment. So in other words, just to make this as simple as possible, the municipality involved is making a motion to dismiss a case because assuming everything, and this is important, assuming everything the plaintiff says, there's a plaintiff suit, says is true, there's no constitutional violation, or if there was a constitutional violation, the right was not clearly established prior to the incident. So, and that's important to understand because when I do talk about, like, for instance, the Rowell case, the other point that I'm going to make is I might say the name's wrong, so I apologize. But some of you might be familiar with these cases, and you might think, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly what happened. Well, here's the reality of the way the law works. When it comes to these types of review, that is what happened. The court has to take the plaintiff's view. So anyway, let's get into the Rowell case here. So the answer to this question, essentially, and this is a oversimplification, but the answer to this question, does the law require the use of de-escalation tactics? The answer is generally no. However, it is, as you'll see as we go through, that it's a little more complicated than that. I will try to tie this all together for you so you'll have something to work with. So, but this quote right out of the Rowell case is, no case law prohibits officers from using physical force without attempting de-escalation techniques. And just because a person, like for instance, in this particular case, Rowell was in what appeared to be a state of excited delirium. He's had a t-shirt on. He was had a garden hose in his hand that he was whipping around with it sounds like a faucet on the end of it. He had some type of planter in his other hand. He had broken some windows in a neighbor's house. The police were called. The officers responded. And he advanced on the officers, swinging the hose. The officers arced their taser. They gave him warnings. And I'm just kind of simplifying this, but gave him warnings to get him to stop. He wouldn't stop. He finally got him. They got near him. They ended up engaging him physically, trying to use restraint tactics. Ultimately, he was arrested, and he subsequently passed away. So, you know, it's a tragedy. It's definitely a tragic case. But the court ruled that in this case, this was objectively reasonable under these circumstances. And it's helpful to take a look at a prior precedent, the Martin case, on the next slide, that where the court compared the behaviors. And I like this because it, I think, really demonstrates how the courts, in a broad view, will look at the cases. So when you look at the contrast here, well, just very quickly, in Martin, what happened was Martin is somewhat similar to start with, naked, battling, tried to get into a woman's apartment. The police are called. They respond. He comes running across the grass towards them. He turns and puts his hands behind him and says, "Take me to jail," or something to that effect. But before the officers can get to him, he starts to jog away. Well, the officers ran after him. They didn't give any warnings. They tackled him. And again, this is the depiction in the case, is that multiple strikes and blows to the head, hammer blows and so forth, as they were described by the officers, in attempts to control him. And they had the weight of, at one point, three total officers on top of him, and ultimately he also passed away. So the comparison here is good because, especially with the first bullets, as you can see here, in Rowell, they tried to communicate with him. So this is where, as Bill has already mentioned, you're not always going to be able to effectively communicate with a person. However, these cases, there's other cases, people that are familiar with Armstrong versus Pinehurst in the 10th Circuit, Perea versus Baca, Berea was the 10th Circuit, Armstrong, I think, was the 4th Circuit. Similar things where the court focused on communication. And like in Perea, there was no attempt at communication, similar to Martin. They just kind of tackled him off of his bike and ended up engaged with him physically without any attempts. Pinehurst, there was effective communication until a commitment order was signed, and then it was like a switch was turned, and that's it, you're going. And that's what led to the struggle that ultimately led to his death. So if you kind of look at it this way, in the terms of what we're going to talk about shortly with priority of life, who's bringing the risk? So in Roel, it was Roel bringing the risk to the officers. In Martin and in Pinehurst and Korea, it was more of the officers bringing the risk to him, so to speak. So there, I think this is a telling person as communication warning. The type of physicality used in Roel, it was more attempts to subdue, restrain arms, restrain legs, as compared to using multiple strikes and blows. And the reality is that a person in a state of excited delirium is not necessarily going to feel the pain, and those blows are not necessarily going to be effective. All right, so now we got to look at, but is there a legal distinction between a person in crisis and a criminal suspect? And, you know, again, the answer on a very superficial level is no. There is no strict legal distinction. In other words, right now, there is no rule that says you, if a person is in crisis, you must handle them this way as compared to a criminal suspect. However, as in the Durrell case, the mental state of the individual is a factor that must be considered when determining the objective reasonableness of the force used. So it fits in together. It fits in with the structure that we already have, that the Graham versus Connor analysis that everybody's used to. I'm sure virtually everybody on this call, that has been the law of the land since you were police officers. Now, in this case, this is another interesting case as far as communication and warnings. And Durrell was in crisis. The police had set up a perimeter around the houses in the area. He had been wandering around for about a half an hour. He had complied with prior instructions by the officers. They were set up on the perimeter. They were waiting for negotiators to come. And then one officer decided that he needed to venture into within the perimeter to reconnoiter the situation. So he did that. He had a shotgun arm, loaded with beanbag rounds. Durrell started to come towards the officer, and he told him to stop, and he ended up firing a beanbag round that impacted in his eye and actually lodged in his eye, causing him to lose the eye and some other injuries. So the court focused on the fact that, you know, again, typical in a Graham analysis, that he really hadn't committed a crime. There was a bunch of officers on the scene already for a half an hour before he shot him. He had an opportunity to observe him for a period of time before firing, there was no real need for him to be where he was, is essentially the way to warn, and no warning was given. So this particular case, the court allowed this to go to trial. So now with that background, so here's where we are right now, and we're going to consider when should we legally then consider de-escalation. So here's where we are so far. It's is it legally required? No. But is it a consideration? Yes. Now, before we get into this part, I got to make this clear. We are not telling you that, and the Roel case doesn't stand for the fact that you shouldn't use de-escalation. What officers have to understand, because as Bill pointed out already, there's such misconception out there as to what de-escalation is. And the last thing we want is officers to hesitate to use force when it's necessary to objectively reasonable and necessary to protect themselves or a third party. That is, we cannot let officers get to that situation. So that's why you have to understand it. So now, when should we consider it? Well, do you have discretionary time? Do you have time to think? Who is at risk and who is causing the risk? And that's going to lead us into priority of life. But the first thing that we have to do is just very, very quickly cover a very complex area of law also. And that is there a legal duty to prevent a person from harming themselves? And the answer again is generally no, there isn't. And the DeShaney case, there set forth that there is no obligation of the state to protect an individual against private violence. That includes self, that would include self. Is there a moral duty? Sure there is, to a point. But it's important to understand, because we don't want officers making decisions about tactics that they're going to use under the wrong assumptions. Because it comes to this: if you decide to act, then liability may result from the course of action and whatever happens as a result of that course of action. So the Glenn versus Washington County case, just very, very quickly, young man emotionally upset. He's holding a knife to his neck. The parents and friends call the police. Sergeant working the road is over the radio trying to set up a staging area for the responding officers. However, two of the officers bypass the staging area. Lucas is standing apparently in the driveway holding a knife up to his neck. And the first officer, and then shortly followed by the second officer, come running down the driveway with their guns out, screaming. Again, this is the way it's depicted in the case, screaming at him to drop the gun, drop the knife, or they're going to kill him. So the second officer comes, it takes up a similar posture. Now the family and friends are trying to de-escalate the officers. They get into the house, they come up with a plan. This all happens within a few minutes. They come up with a plan to fire beanbag rounds at him, but if he moves towards the house, they're going to shoot him. So they fire the beanbag rounds, and he does move towards the house, and they end up shooting him. Once again, case in this particular case is allowed to proceed to a jury. So you don't want to be the one escalating the situation, because, you know, again, look at it from objectively here. We have a young man threatening to kill himself with a knife. The officers definitely did not try to de-escalate the situation, and if anything, probably did escalate it. This is definitely what we do not want. These are people that are in need, and they need help. And what we have to do a better job of in the law enforcement is identifying risk and who is at risk. But the primary goal of the police response, right? I work for Lexapol now. It's a policy company. It's a liability risk management company. But here's the reality. The primary goal of all police response to these situations is to do the right thing for the right reasons, to try to protect that person that needs assistance, to try to protect the officers that are responding to it, and not put themselves unnecessarily at risk. Reduce liability is merely a benefit. It's not the primary motivator. So, you know, we need to apply the proper use of discretionary time to these situations. So is time on your side? Do we have discretionary time? We don't need to belabor this. I hope everybody understands this. It is very, very critical to build this into your training, that if you have a situation that sometimes there is no discretionary time that results in discretionary time, that, in other words, things slow down, the situation changes. But this is very, very important. And if officers had recognized that, in not only the Glenn case, but in many other cases, then the Duro case, it may have been a different result. So now we're going to get into priority of life, and we're going to talk about how this applies and how this is overall concept, the overall legal concepts that we've talked about so far. So priority of life involves determining who is at risk and who's causing risk. So we have roughly three different categories of officers involved. People involved. We have police officers, we have innocent persons, and we have criminal suspects and persons in crisis. Now we have them together. Are they the same? No, they're not the same in the sense of priority of life is not about culpability. It's about who's causing the risk and who is at risk. So culpability does not matter. Again, look at the Roel case from the beginning. This is a man in a severe state of crisis, in excited delirium. Is he culpable? That would be a difficult argument to make. However, the state of his actions are what are going to judge the response. And in that particular case, they didn't have a lot of discretionary time as he was advancing on him. So we don't need in reality, too, a person in crisis just can be an innocent person. It's just sometimes life just catches up, and it doesn't even necessarily mean that they're mentally ill. It just means that situationally there's something going on they can't handle right now. So it's best for officers, from an officer safety perspective, and that's a huge one, too, is that when you engage with somebody physically, you're much, much more likely as an officer to be injured. This is definitely a high risk area for officers because the people do not feel the pain. So let's just go through a couple very, very quick examples here. So in the first one, you get a call, maybe it's a third party call, maybe the person called a hotline and, you know, I can't deal with this anymore. Suicidal ideation, officers are dispatched. The person answers the door. There's no signs of weapons. There's no need to, you know, this is an obvious, it should be an obvious one. This is how the priority of life needs to be analyzed. So are the police officers, who's causing the risk in that particular case? Yeah, arguably you could say that maybe he is causing the risk to himself. However, as the officers go in, he's communicative. He doesn't have any obvious weapons. He's willing to get help. This is clearly a case where there's no need to rush, and you know, we definitely don't want to be the officer causing the risk. Now, the officer causing the risk in this analysis. Now let's go to the second example, and I'm actually going to use the Casella versus Hughes case, the facts of that with this, which is similar to what I have here on the screen. But what happened in Casella, this is a Supreme Court, recent Supreme Court case. Officers get a call for a woman with a large knife hacking at a tree. So they arrive and they see two women, one walking towards the other with the knife. She matches the description that was given in the original call. And officers give her commands to drop the knife. She stops. She's just a few feet away from the other woman. The other woman is telling her to calm down, telling the officers to calm down. Officers are giving her commands to drop the knife, and they perceive in this particular case, now they're behind a locked fence, so they cannot get through the fence, so they don't have any obvious alternatives here. So in this particular analysis, is there an innocent person at risk? And their answer in their minds, which is not, I don't think, unreasonable, is yes, that she was at risk. You know, without getting into the details of you know, Bill's of the four science learning, but action versus reaction, that woman could have easily had attacked her with a knife before the officers would have had a chance to effectively respond to terminate the threat. So the officer made a decision and fired at the woman with the knife and hit her multiple times. So the Supreme Court, in reversing the Ninth Circuit, ruled that while they didn't outright rule that that was objectively reasonable, they disagreed with the Ninth Circuit by saying, look, this is not, we're not going to go there. We're not going to determine whether it's objectively reasonable, but all we do know this. It also was not clearly established that under those circumstances, this was unreasonable by the officers. So this is it's just a good example of these are the types of cases that they're so difficult and the public doesn't understand that the risk involved here, if the officers did not take action, there was a chance, we will never know what would have happened, but the risk could have been significant to the woman, the innocent person that was involved in this. But now let's transition that. Let's say that didn't happen. And in the third example, let's just say that they are able to get through the fence and she does back away, but she does have the knife and she goes into the house and the officers are able to determine from the woman out front that she does this, she gets, you know, whatever, there's nobody else in the house, there's no threats in there. Well, at this point now we can slow the whole thing down again. This is where we transition. Originally it appeared as if there was no discretionary time. Now she's in there, now we can isolate, now we can contemplate other strategies, but keep her isolated so that now the last thing that we want to do is escalate the situation by doing an immediate entry and perhaps provoking a situation where not only are the officers or the person at risk, but the officers are at risk. And this is the problem with these cases. And it's these cases we read about because of the result. The person is shot or otherwise injured by the police. However, What happens, what gets ignored is the process that's followed. And what gets ignored is the fact that in many of these cases, the officers are actually putting themselves at some pretty significant risk of injury. And when you look at the LEOCA data that's out there, law enforcement officers killed and assaulted, the stats are there. There's a lot of officers, and there's a lot of detailed information about officers killed, but not so much about officers assaulted, not as much detail. But these are clearly dangerous situations, and we need to avoid creating the risk. So just a couple of quick takeaways here before I turn it back over to Bill. So, look, if the only person that's causing the risk is the only one that's at risk, then we need to isolate or disengage. Slow things down. Avoid placing yourself at risk. You know, try not to create, through your tactics, any type of liability. Now, there's no legal duty to prevent a person from harming him or herself. But once again, I'm not saying that because we want people to just say, okay, bye-bye, we're leaving now. That's not the situation. That might be a situation, depending upon the facts. But we want you to understand this so that, number one, you do not make a tactical decision based on a flawed legal assumption. But number two, we want you to use discretionary time to the best of your ability. So in sum, here's the reality. The law, as it has been interpreted with de-escalation, with Doral, with the fact that the person's mental state is a factor to be considered under a Graham analysis, all of this is entirely, the law is entirely consistent with priority of life. It's a risk-based analysis, and this is something that can be quickly done with officers. And then once you get to that situation where now you are going to engage and try to engage with the person, now Bill is going to tell you about the responsibility zone.
Thanks, Mike. It's always helpful to have a clear encapsulation of the rules of the encounter before we start looking at the tactics and the strategies of the officers involved. So one of the concepts that Forest Science talks about in our de-escalation program is the responsibility zone. And it's an old concept, but it initially evolved in the 70s by someone, a very well-known communicator in the 70s named Thomas Gordon. And Gordon called it his problem window, in which both individuals in an encounter have a responsibility to address that encounter, or an obligation or a chance to influence the encounter that existed between them and another person they're dealing with. Gordon primarily looks at the problems that people bring to the situation. We're spinning this a little differently, because from our understanding of the encounter that exists between officers and the individuals they work with in the street, is that both permit and have a responsibility for permitting communication and problem solving to occur within that zone. And we call it, therefore, the responsibility zone. So both the person and the officer own responsibility for control of the zone or the conceptual area of interaction between them. Both can control the encounter. Now, one or the other can also steal control of the zone, such that they eliminate or severely restrict what the other can do in that zone. For instance, drugs, a serious psychological issue, or extreme emotional arousal can impair a person's thought and communication, thus severely challenging an officer's ability to establish contact, build rapport, influence, persuade, or even tactically operate in that zone. The Lucas Glenn case just discussed illustrates how you need to understand this perspective on the situation, as well as how not to push the zone with a preemptive use of force. You see, if you can't establish contact with a person in crisis, you can't get them to focus on you, to pay attention to you in some format. You can't do anything verbally or psychologically. And by the way, your challenge is not to diagnose, but to figure out how you can cut through
their disorganized thinking. Even skilled professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, can't immediately diagnose someone. But functionally, if you can establish contact, you can then build rapport, influence, and persuade. First, though, you need to focus on the person's behavior, not their diagnosis. Also look at where is this occurring? What's their perspective? How do they see you? How do they see the world? And most importantly, if you can discern purpose, if you can figure out why they're doing what they're doing, not from the point of cause, but how they're trying to create something, you'll have a key. You'll have a key to resolving this situation. And I repeat again, functionally, if you can't establish contact, you can't build rapport, you can't influence, you can't persuade, you can't talk to somebody. So we need to look at, what is the purpose? Where is this occurring? Is there any purpose to their behavior? Sometimes there's not. We also tend to see, and this is characteristic of, I think, most human encounters, we tend to see that behavior in the other person is caused by something. But you can't often change what that cause is. You often can't restore relationships that may have caused depression and suicidal ideation in someone. You can't solve financial problems. You can never bring a checkbook big enough to solve some of the financial problems that people have that are in a state of crisis that you meet in the street. So you can't restore relationships. You can't solve financial crisis, but you can still work with the person by understanding how their actions are an attempt to solve a problem. And if you can incorporate that, when possible, into your solutions, you'll then have a golden bridge to guide them toward your solution to their crisis. The suicidal person, for instance, likely isn't even going to react to your threatening them, because that's the very intention of their behavior. So if you have your weapon out for your protection, keeping it below your face level, just as a simple tactic, will allow that person to see your face. And that will then allow you to communicate with them person to person. You see, even having the gun up in front of our face blocks important cues we can pick up from them, and also blocks their ability to read us. And how they read us can be really critical if we're going to be effective with someone. So dropping the gun just below face level could be very helpful if you need to have that weapon out. Also, importantly, if someone's having auditory hallucinations, such as they're hearing voices, many people who have had that delusion in the street say that being able to read the lips of the officer speaking to them allows them to isolate out the officer from their hallucinations, allows them to hear the words the officer is saying because they connect to the person, to the officer's lips. And so that can be a very helpful sort of process for the officer. Of course, isolation from crowds and other sorts of things that will allow the officer to be isolated within the person's perceptual framework, and then will allow the officer to have more influence. But remember, sometimes you can't even establish contact. If the person is under the influence of drugs or too profoundly affected by a psychological issue, or their thinking is so disorganized, they may be unreachable. And here's an illustration.
All right, we are back. That little audio clip training came from a webinar that we attended, and a lot of good information that they were giving us. And we're not going to solve the problems of mental health, and we're not going to be able to train you adequately in mental health emergency response in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour in an audio program. But if you'd like more information, contact us at helpdesk@privateofficer.com or give us a call at 704-831-8109. We do a lot of church security training. We do active shooter training. We do
all kind of public safety training. But, you know, if you'd like more information, please send us an email at helpdesk@privateofficer.com. We also want to recognize a couple people this week for their heroic efforts. Shirley Damon is being recognized for life-saving after giving CPR at a mall. She works mall security in Indianapolis. And also Charles Scott Taylor. We'd like to recognize him. He received an award for being an advanced officer, taking advanced training, and really putting it to use for his company, so we recognize him as well. If you have an employee, a manager, an owner, or even yourself who'd like to be recognized, send an email to helpdesk@privateofficer.com with that nomination, and we'll contact you and be happy to recognize that person. Let me see, what else do we have? Also, if you're in the Bay Area in California and you're looking for a great company to work for, Valiant Private Security is hiring right now. Call our friends out there, Mr. Libby at Valiant Private Security. Check them out online at valiantprivatesecurity.com today. They have many different positions. They're a great company to work for, a growing company. And, of course, tell them Rick sent you, and that'll get you an instant raise. No, that'll definitely get you an interview and a great job. So make sure that you check them out today. If you're interested in advertising in our newsletters, we have a special offer that we just put out this week. $10, just $10, will get you an ad in our newsletter and on our social media. $10 a week, you can advertise your business, an item for sale, or a help wanted ad. Contact helpdesk@privateofficer.com. So much more that we want to talk about. Time is slipping away. So with that, I'm going to bid you adieu. We'll be back here on Sunday for On the Legal Side. But until then, as always, we want you to be safe, be blessed, and we'll see you back here on the radio.